This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program. Now here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll discuss the fiscal cliff and what a compromise might look like with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar and Economic Policy Institute Research and Policy Director Josh Bivens. But first, AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon joins us. Jackie, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Jackie, premiums for the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program are expected to increase next year by an average of about 3.4%. Talk about the impact on federal employees.
Well, these are relatively low increases compared with previous years, but in the context of a pay freeze that's 2 years and at least another several months, any increase is unaffordable. The averages, which don't really tell you a lot, are going to be about $166 per year for family coverage and $71.50 for self-only coverage. Which, again, doesn't sound like a huge amount to some people, but for people in the lower grades who are already struggling to keep body and soul together, that's a significant extra amount out of pocket in order to keep health insurance.
And to put it into context a little bit, the last several years there have been some pretty significant increases in the premiums for federal employees, right?
Yeah, it's been a while since we've seen double-digit increases, but in 2011 we saw a 7% increase. So, you know, it's fairly recent, and you know, these increases, small or large, don't happen in a political vacuum when the insurance companies are worried about popular sentiment or sentiment in the Congress about restraining their ability to charge whatever they want. They'll moderate for a little while, and we may be in one of those kind of periods right now.
As you said, of course, federal employees are under a two-year pay freeze, which will be extended by at least a few more months. What are some federal employees saying that you might have spoken to about this issue?
Well, I haven't really talked to people so much about the premium increases, but what, of course, is on everybody's mind right now are the budget negotiations, and the specter of Simpson-Bowles' revival has reared its ugly head again, and there were changes there proposed for FEHBP, the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program, which was to turn it into a voucher, just like Paul Ryan and the House Republicans proposed for Medicare. It's actually written very explicitly in the Simpson and Bowles recommendations to voucherize FEHBP as a sort of trial run for the voucherization of Medicare. And people should be very, very concerned about this because it has a lot of support on among both Democrats and Republicans, powerful Democrats and powerful Republicans. And the way this would work is that instead of getting a certain percentage of your premium paid, you would get a certain amount of money to use exclusively for the purchase of health insurance. And that amount of money would be adjusted annually, but not by the rate of premium increase. For example, this year it wouldn't have gone up by 3.4%. It would have gone up by some smaller amount, either CPI or some have said GDP growth. You know, some measure that would be completely unrelated to healthcare costs that basically would result in a gradual cost shifting. You know, more and more and more costs to be borne by the employees.
And I think you hit on a great point there. Whatever the amount is that a federal employee is allotted, if there's more in the cost of the actual health care than the federal employees left paying the difference, right?
Absolutely.
So what does that mean in a day and age when federal employees, like we said, are already under a two-year pay freeze, their premiums are increasing, and one of the possible outcomes of all this could be, hey, we're going to voucherize it, and you possibly pay more?
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things. One is that, you know, the line used by our enemies, I'll just use the word enemies, people who are trying to take away everything we've got from pay to jobs to health insurance to retirement benefits, say, you know, why should federal employees have health insurance when so many people in the private sector don't have it? You know, it's a very perverse perspective because obviously the problem to be solved is that so many people have nothing, not that we have, you know, I'm not going to call it a fairly decent plan, but we have a plan. But, you know, this is part of the whole race to the bottom. And there are unfortunately many in Congress who believe that the federal government's been a laggard in this race. And they want us to get going, and they want us to get going right away. And health insurance is one of the places they want us to resemble Walmart more than we do.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government. And we're here with Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. So then, Jackie, my question for you is, what is the response by AFGE on some of these initiatives?
Oh, we're fighting them with everything we've got. And whoever's listening, I hope you pick up the phone right this minute and call your senators and your representative and tell them, absolutely, AFGE, federal employees, have given already to deficit reduction. We've given $103 billion, and no other group of Americans given one red cent. We've had retirement cuts. We've had a pay freeze, an extended pay freeze, and there is just absolutely no justification to come back to this well. Likewise, there is absolutely no justification to making FEHBP less and less and less affordable for federal employees. You know, part of the campaign to demonize federal employees is try to pretend that they're not just lazy bureaucrats, but they're lazy bureaucrats doing nothing for six-figure salaries. And the reality, of course, which your lawmaker really needs to hear, is what you actually are living on, that you are making in the 30s or 40s or $50,000 trying to raise a family on those very, very modest incomes. And these kind of cuts really, really hurt.
Yeah, many times in the discussion, we see federal employees being separated from the middle class in the debate. But the reality is, most federal employees are the middle class.
Absolutely. I mean, it depends how you define the middle class. But, you know, 20% of all federal employees make under $30,000 a year. That's barely middle class. That's somebody who's hanging on to middle class status, depending on how big their family is, by their fingernails. So, yeah, these are just unbearable cuts, intolerable cuts, unjustified cuts. And you got to let your lawmaker know.
One point I want to go back to on the Federal Employees Health Benefits Program is this small but very significant sect of federal employees, about 250,000 or so that AFGE has estimated, don't make enough money to actually pay for their premiums. Tell me about those people.
Well, you know, that again, that number is an estimate, but even OPM admits that number is growing and has grown, certainly in the years during the pay freeze. And there's a question about whether they'll be eligible for the subsidies under the Affordable Care Act. So, FEHBP, you know, even though it's trotted out so often as some kind of model, it's not really a model when it fails to cover all of its targeted population, if it's too expensive for that many people. You know, and again, that 250,000 number we're talking about are not people who are eligible to participate but have coverage from other sources. We're talking about uninsured federal employees. It's horrifying, and it should be a subject of, you know, of great importance to OPM and this administration, but you know, their only response is to, you know, brag about how low their premium increases are when they're already so high, they're out of reach. If people are taking a look at the health insurance, you know, the biggest plan in the country is the Blue Cross Blue Shield standard option. And, you know, that has more people in it than, you know, the next one in line is far, far, far. Number two has far, far fewer. Remember, if you choose the basic instead of the standard, they pay essentially nothing if you go out of network. Now, in most cases, you won't even notice that because the networks are big. But God forbid you need some kind of specialist that's not in their network, or your doctor decides to drop out of their network. You have to really bear that in mind. You'll be saving some money, but you are giving up a chance of having that decision to go out of network when circumstances call for it.
Certainly a good point, and something our listeners certainly would need to pay attention to. One of the things that we talked about earlier, Jackie, is the Simpson-Bowles proposal, and part of that has brought up discussions and some reports about how federal employees are paid and talking about specifically the GS schedule. Tell me your thoughts on that as a way to pay federal employees and this discussion around whether or not it should be.
Well, you know, it's unusual that AFGE describes any aspect of federal compensation as pretty good, but certainly our pay system is a good one. Now, if it were fully funded, it would be a great one. And I'm not by any chance suggesting that the pay freeze and the threat in Simpson-Bowles of another 3 years of pay freeze are not horrendous. But the kind of attack that the GS system has been under from these right-wing think tanks, and sadly even CBO jumped on the bandwagon, although its sister research organization, CRS, the Congressional Research Service, did an excellent job of, I think, criticizing the CBO report. We like it because it attaches pay to a set of job duties. And in so doing, you avoid one of the worst phenomena having to do with pay, and that is pay discrimination. The federal government doesn't care who holds the job. If the job has been graded a GS-9, if you're a woman, if you're a minority, if you're a man, it doesn't matter. You're going to get the same salary. And so it's a very good system in that it really does pay people according to objective criteria. And the objective criteria are, you know, whether you have the qualifications for the job and whether you perform the job, not the color of your skin, not your gender, not your ethnicity.
Before we end here, I want to talk about the broader issue and how some of these things that we've talked about, increasing rates in health insurance premiums, possibly voucherizing the program, potential changes to the general schedule or how federal employees are paid, possibly things like increases in what a federal employee contributes to his or her retirement plan. How do all of these things factor into the way the government does business and the way that it recruits and retains its employees?
Recruitment and retention are a management concern. Obviously, there's a point at which federal compensation becomes so low compared to other employers that the federal government will have a hard time hiring or retaining people with the kind of skills that it needs. And then, you know, what it does, it's penny-wise and pound-foolish. It says, okay, we can't recruit at this measly little salary that we're authorized to offer. We got to contract out. And then when they contract out, they pay far, far more. So taxpayers end up worse off. That's a problem that, you know, we find all the time. You know, I think federal employees have shown that they stay on in their government jobs for a lot of reasons that aren't economic. Our members, I know from personal experience, are very, very committed to the missions of their agencies. They're very patriotic. So many of them have served in the military and you know, who wind up not just in as civilians at DOD or in the Veterans Administration, but throughout the government, continuing public service. And it's a very noble calling, and people aren't necessarily motivated by money. On the other hand, they've got families to feed, and they want to maintain a decent standard of living. So we pretty much argue on that basis because it's utterly shameful to have members of the U.S. Congress stand up and talk about taking pay and benefits away from a VA nursing assistant who's making $24,000 a year or a Border Patrol agent making $40,000 a year. These people are motivated by a public service ethos. And I don't know if they're going to quit if they don't get their pay raise, but their lives are really turned upside down by, like anybody else's, by an inability to pay the bills.
Jackie Simon, AFGE's Public Policy Director. Jackie, thank you for your time today and your commitment to federal employees.
You're very welcome. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn more about the fiscal cliff with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause. Bob was also a former congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman Edgar, welcome back to the program.
It's great to be on the show.
Congressman, with Democrats and Republicans working to avoid a fiscal cliff, what are your thoughts on the situation?
I think that as a result of the outcome of the last election and the pressure that's being put on by business, labor, average ordinary citizens, the fiscal cliff will not be something that Congress will go over. I think you're going to see very quickly a proposal, probably one that helps and hurts everybody. The Simpson-Bowles proposal, I think, forms a framework of it. I think there are going to be increases in tax rates, and I think the wealthiest of citizens are going to have to pay more. But I do think there will also have to be some cuts in areas that many of us are concerned about. They need to be balanced. But I don't think anyone seriously thinks we ought to do across-the-board cuts. I think people want to see thoughtful cuts. And I hope that the administration, the White House, the House and Senate will get to it. I remember when I served in Congress, one of the holidays, namely Christmas, tended to make a lot of things happen. And I wouldn't be surprised if on the 23rd or 24th of December, the deal was cut simply because House and Senate members want to go home for the holidays. I wish that they would do it more quickly. I think there's a good sign this particular week where a number of senators and House members on the Republican side are disowning their silly pledge never to raise taxes ever. Government is based on doing what average ordinary citizens want done. You can't build highways and bridges and roads and schools and libraries without having resources to pay for them. Everyone wants their taxes to be low, but they also want all the services. And I think the election that just took place was very helpful, because on every speech of the president and the current administration, they pointed out that the wealthiest of Americans are going to have to pay more. And I think the president also recognizes that some fiscal slowdown and fiscal cuts are going to have to be made to make up for the trillions of dollars needed to address the deficit. Let me just say one thing, though, that I don't think many people are talking about. I get really, really frustrated with conservative Republicans and Democrats who wring their hands about the debt and deficit, and yet they voted for the two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan without raising resources to pay for them. In fact, at the very time they went to war, they gave the largest tax cut in the history of the United States. So some of the very people who have to fix the problem that we're facing are the very people who caused the problem. Whether you're for or against the war in Iraq or for and against the war in Afghanistan, no one should ever vote to go to war without recognizing that resources are going to have to be raised to pay for it. In the Bush administration, they didn't even have it in the budget. It was off budget. Good news is the Obama administration has at least put the money in the budget for the conduct of the war. But Democrats and Republicans have to own up to the fact that in October of 2002, most of the people who are still in Congress voted in support of going to war in Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11, and yet they didn't couple their votes for war with the ability to raise the resources to pay for it. And what they're doing now is they're paying for those wars on the back of senior citizens, on the back of the poor, on the back of students. And it's just an outrage, and somebody's got to call them out for it.
Congressman, you spent 12 years in the House of Representatives. I'm wondering if you can share with our audience a little bit about how a deal might get done. Is it something where people will be talking about it behind the scenes and negotiating at the table late hours at night? How will this thing unfold to ultimately get something done?
Well, what's not talked about is a lot of the work will be done by the senior staff of senators and House members who are I would say every day between now and the time a deal is set, working to try to convince, at least at the staff level, what revenues through tax increases and tax changes need to take place and what reductions need to take place. Once that occurs, then I think it's up to the president to invite the leadership of the House and Senate down into the White House. Some of it has to be done, unfortunately, behind closed doors. And I learned as a member of Congress that you have to be careful, particularly about issues that deal with tax changes, because sometimes things that are very popular can be very destructive when you cost them out. And so they used to bring out the bills out of the what I affectionately called the Ways to Be Mean Committee, which is the tax writing committee on the House side. They used to bring those out under a closed rule simply because it was too easy for members of Congress to add amendments that would either raise or lower taxes in an inappropriate way and not get the results that are necessary for having adequate revenues to pay for the issues that we face. I would say one other complication, and that is over the years, the House has divided up responsibility on issues to committees and subcommittees, and you've got the same on the Senate side. There's going to have to be a little bit of ego disarmament on the part of committee chairs that they will want to consider the different provisions of this massive bill, and yet there has to be a little bit of faith in the leadership of the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans and the White House, that once a deal is struck, they don't manipulate the deal through long hours of hearings and committee jurisdiction fights that get us too close to what is called the cliff. I don't think we're going to go over that cliff. I think saner heads are going to prevail. I think enough Republicans and enough Democrats will join together and get something to the president's desk before Christmas. That's just a strong instinct on my part, but I think it's the right thing to do. There's too many bad things that happen if we don't get serious about this. And I think it's been a good thing to have this come after a fairly convincing election. If the election had been a split decision where one candidate won the popular vote and the other candidate won the electoral college vote, or if we were still in the courts challenging the election, I think we'd be in big trouble as a nation. But I think the conservative Republicans realize that this is not the time to play games. This is not the time to use the filibuster to do what they've done more recently and just delay and oppose everything. This is the time to act. And if they don't act, I think conservatives in the House and Senate are going to pay a heavy price.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause, also a former congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman Edgar, Republicans have indicated a willingness to put revenue on the table, but I'm wondering if you can explain the difference to our audience between closing some tax loopholes and actually raising tax rates.
Well, actually, I think we have to do both. There are obviously loopholes that need to be addressed, and you could do it in a fairly sophisticated way. People making over $1 million a year probably shouldn't get all of the tax benefits and loopholes that have snuck into the tax system. Some of us think maybe it makes sense to go back to the rates that were in place during the Clinton administration. Horrors to horrors, if we went back to the rates that were in place during the Eisenhower administration, the super wealthy would be paying a huge amount more than they're currently paying. And I think the jury is really out on whether or not tax reduction actually creates jobs. I think that argument has been challenged by people like Bob Reich, who was Labor Secretary, and others who have looked at it carefully. In a book that Bob Reich wrote about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, called Aftershock, he pointed out that in 1915, Henry Ford doubled the wages of his employees, and he was thrown out of his country club. He was ostracized. He was called a communist by many of the capitalists of the time. When asked why he did it, he had a very good explanation. He said, well, if I didn't pay a living wage to my employees, they couldn't buy my cars. By lifting their wages, they bought more cars, and I became wealthy. And I think the wealthy of this country have to recognize that they've got to pay their fair share of taxes. The secretaries and lower-level employees shouldn't be bearing the burden for the rest of the country. It's not enough just to deal with tax loopholes and tax rates. We've got to look at other things like reductions of some of the social programs or phasing some of the changes in over time. But we also need to recognize that it has to be done in a balanced way. And I'm a big fan of having the government actually spend some money on infrastructure projects. And I think we should have a strong practical defense system, but we currently have a defense system that is exquisitely prepared for World War II rather than a lean, focused defense operation that could cost less but be as efficient. And our current system is really a defense system that has been pork-barreled over the years, and we're building weapon systems that are no longer needed and no longer valuable. And there's plenty of resources in that defense budget to phase down over time and get to the kind of balance and reduction of deficit that we're looking at.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our discussion with Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Ecker.
Attention AFGE members. Did you know about AFGE's new service to assist you with legal rights issues? It's called the AFGE Legal Rights Attorney Program, which offers free attorney representation in cases brought by AFGE councils and locals on behalf of AFGE members. The program, administered by AFGE's General Counsel's Office, has handled more than 150 cases since 2005 and has won millions of dollars in back pay for our members. The Legal Rights Attorney Program is designed to take cases that will be brought to arbitration, the Merit System Protection Board, or other review boards where both back pay and attorney's fees are available. These cases include removal, suspension, reduction in pay, reduction in grade, and furlough. For information about the program, please email legalrights@afge.org. Not a member? Become one and take advantage of this incredible resource today.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We're continuing with Bob Ecker, the president and CEO of Common Cause, as well as a former congressman from Pennsylvania. Congressman Ecker, I want to get into some of the initiatives that Common Cause is taking on at the rest of 2012 going into 2013. Give me a sense for some of your top priorities.
Well, over the last 5 years, we've tried to reinvigorate Common Cause, and we loved a headline that was in the Washington Post that called us the Uncommon Cause. As you remember, we took on the Koch brothers 2 years ago, exposed them. We took on the Supreme Court and its lack of ethics. As we move forward, we're working on several major initiatives. We just finished a major project on making sure the election was fair, and we think that we need to have a national law working on not only election protection to stop deceptive practices, but a national set of principles on elections. It was outrageous how many long lines there were in the past. We're also working on something called the American Legislative Exchange Council, called ALEC. It does about 75% of its work over the last 40 years as a charity And yet, through investigation that Common Cause has done, we discovered that 75% of their work is hardcore lobbying. And they file with the IRS and call themselves a charity, give the corporations and individuals who give them money a tax break. I personally filed a whistleblower complaint against ALEC. And when the IRS rules on that whistleblower complaint, many corporations and individuals will be fined and penalized for abusing the tax system. But probably one of the most important things that we're doing right now is we're trying to get the attention of the United States Senate to change their rules and go back to a talking filibuster. We've actually gone a little bit further. On the 10th of December, we will be in the federal courts here in D.C. We argue that the filibuster, the parliamentary procedure that was put in place in the Senate rules that forces every vote in the Senate that is controversial to be a 60-vote supermajority, that it in fact is unconstitutional. One of our board members, who's our lead attorney, has put several hundred thousand dollars of pro bono legal work together, read the Federalist Papers, looked at English common law, discovered that no other democracy has a rule in place that allows for one half of its legislative body to have veto power over all the other parts of the legislative process with a supermajority vote. In fact, founding fathers warned against it. They were smart enough to put six instances in the Constitution for a supermajority. You can't impeach the president without a supermajority vote. You can't have a trade bill without a supermajority vote. You can't amend the Constitution without a supermajority vote. They argued that on all other issues, it should be a majority rule. And Common Cause believes that democracy ought to be based on majority rule with respect to the minority. So in our court filing, we have pointed out, and we think we can prove, that the filibuster is not in the Constitution. It was invented by Aaron Burr 20 years after the Constitution, wasn't named a filibuster till 50 years after the Constitution. Up until 1970, it was used more often to protect slavery and lynching laws than it was human rights or civil rights or people's rights. And in fact, in 1939, when the movie Mr. Smith Goes to Washington was headlined and shown all over the world, there were zero filibusters. In the last several years, there have been hundreds of filibusters, and appointments that the president makes have been filibustered. Laws like disclosure legislation, which would give us an access to who is putting money into campaigns, got 59 votes in the Senate, but failed because it didn't have 60 votes. And so we at Common Cause are out there pushing the issue of the unconstitutionality of the filibuster. And while the Constitution gives the House and Senate the right to set their own rules, we found out in history the courts have pushed back and said, yes, you can set your own rules, but your own rules can't be unconstitutional. Our pressure in the federal courts is leading the senators, particularly some of the newer and younger senators, to recognize that the filibuster has been abused and needs to be changed. And we hope that they will act in January to get back to majority rule. But if that fails, if the senators who want to change the rules fail to change those rules, we're hopeful that we can convince the courts to push back on the Senate and declare the filibuster unconstitutional.
This is a fascinating debate. How would business on Capitol Hill change if the filibuster went back to being a talking filibuster?
Well, it would be very much like when I served in Congress. Nothing was put in place during the 12 years that I served in Congress by one party alone. Even when the Democrats controlled the House, the Senate, and the White House under the Carter administration, the Older Americans Act, Head Start, the First Energy Bill, the work to clean up our toxic waste was all a bipartisan effort. But in the House, you only needed a majority of 435 House members to support an issue. In the Senate, you only needed 51 or one more than half of the senators voting to support an issue. And then they worked out a compromise. The filibuster has led to the conflict that most Americans think has broken Washington, I think we would get back to more collegial work. When I served in Congress, my best friends were moderate Republicans. Jake Javits in New York, Senator Brooks from Massachusetts, Senator Hines and Schweiker from Pennsylvania, my home state. We worked collegially after election, believing we were elected to serve the public interest and not the special interest. That's all changed, and my hope is that we can get back to majority rule with respect to the minority. And here's one interesting footnote. It may be a little complicated to understand, but the senators who can block legislation with only 41 senators can block anything that comes before the Senate. They can come from small states, North Dakota, South Dakota, Delaware, Montana, and represent only 14% of the American people in terms of total population. That's an outrage. We believe that the whole of the Senate should be reflected. If you can't get a majority to approve a piece of legislation, it should fail. But on every issue, you shouldn't have to have a supermajority, and the Founding Fathers thought that was right as well. So hopefully we'll win in the courts, and if we continue to put the pressure on, I think the Senate needs to find a way to change it. Senator Tom Harkin has an interesting idea. He says, let's leave it at 60 votes as a supermajority vote, but 3 days later make it 57, and a few days later make it 55, and over a 2 or 3 week period, let's go down to a majority vote. That makes sense to me. It also, there's a number of senators who want to go back to a talking filibuster and several who want to stop the process of filibustering at the front end. Those who support the filibuster say it helps to keep debate longer and more intense. That's actually not happening, because once a filibuster is called, if they can't get the votes required, the bill is simply pulled. So health care was weakened because of the filibuster. The DREAM Act got helping young immigrants have a path to citizenship, got 55 votes and failed. And your listeners will be interested, particularly those in government service, that Medicare only got 55 votes in 1965. If Medicare came up for a vote in the United States Senate today, it would fail because it could not muster the 60 votes needed to even consider the legislation. The filibuster has damaged Washington, has damaged collegiality, and needs to either be changed by being ruled unconstitutional, or the Senate needs to stand up and fix that problem.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Bob Edgar, the president and CEO of Common Cause, as well as a former Pennsylvania congressman. Congressman Edgar, a big issue for Common Cause is campaign finance reform. Can you talk to our listeners about how money impacted the recent election cycle?
Well, there's a myth that money didn't have the impact that many of us thought it would have because of Citizens United, the decision of the Supreme Court, where it gave corporations and labor unions the ability to use their corporate treasury. The super PACs, the myth is that they didn't have the impact that they might have. I think the reality is that money influenced this election. From my opinion, good money, as opposed to bad and dark money, won the election. Those that won, including the President of the United States, had to raise $1 billion. Many of the senators who won had to set up super PACs and raise tons and tons of money because their opponents were also raising that money. Common Cause believes that now's the time for President Obama to have a White House summit on reform. At the top of that summit, he ought to repair and put in place a campaign financing system for the next presidential election. I don't want whoever is president of the United States moving forward to spend 200 or 300 days out of a 4-year term raising money for their reelection. Once they're nominated, there ought to be a system in place similar to what we had in place after Watergate, where presidential candidates, once nominated, would get funds from the federal treasury. They would be limited. We also need to have our public airways opened up so that more free time is freed up for our elections. Much of the $4 or $5 billion that was spent in this election were spent on television ads produced in Hollywood rather than the candidates getting free access to the airways. Those airways are public treasure and should not simply be given to corporate influencers. Common Cause also would like to see the House and Senate pass what's called fair elections. Fair elections now would give candidates the opportunity to voluntarily run for office without taking any special interest money. My friend Bill Moyers says this is the most dangerous moment in American history for democracy. We're either going to be a nation that's of and for and by the people, or of and for and by large corporations and the wealthy. And money had a fairly positive result in this election, but it's so easy to look at House and Senate races in the future on both parties, where $5, $10, $15 million of super PAC money or bad wealthy individuals like the casino magnate in Las Vegas can influence the election. Our friends David and Charles Koch, the Koch brothers, they have personally financed members of the House of Representatives to get elected who serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee, and those conservative members that they've elected have signed pledges not to support any regulation of clean air and clean water because they make their billions of dollars of profit in their Coke industry business by polluting the air and polluting the water. I think we've got to recognize that money is a corrosive influence in our system, and Common Cause is dedicated to make sure that we have public financing. We're working hard state by state. New York is our next battlefield. It's a state where the governor is talked about supporting public financing. We installed public financing in Connecticut, Maine, and Arizona for the state legislative races, and it's working. We want to spread that good virus across the country.
Former Congressman Bob Edgar, now the president and CEO of Common Cause. Congressman Edgar, always a pleasure to have you on the program. Thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Great to be with you, and happy holidays.
Thank you. You as well. You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll continue our fiscal cliff discussion with Economic Policy Institute Research and Policy Director Josh Bivens.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Josh Bivens, the Research and Policy Director for the Economic Policy Institute. Josh, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Josh, as the fiscal cliff looms, EPI has released a budget proposal aimed at creating jobs, letting some tax cuts expire, and also strengthening the social safety net. Can you tell us more about the plan?
Yeah. So we actually have kind of two plans out there. One is a very short-term thing just to get policymakers through the end of the year and not have them do any particular damage in the negotiations over the fiscal cliff, and then sort of a more ambitious blue sky plan. And the one you're talking about is the more ambitious one. And basically, it was a plan we did. It's a 10-year budget plan. It was part of a big project with sort of a bunch of other think tanks, and we laid out a couple principles. I mean, number one is we have to solve the jobs crisis first. That should be first and foremost in everyone's mind. And that actually means in the next couple of years, targeting bigger budget deficits to do things like finance aid to state and local governments, infrastructure investments, continue the emergency unemployment insurance benefits that are still so necessary and support the economy. And so we actually provide enough money in the next couple of years to get us back to a full economic recovery, something with, you know, less than 5% unemployment rate. Then we also have a couple other principles: no cuts to the social insurance programs, Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, including no simple cost shifting, just sort of giving people a voucher and letting them go, you know, on their own into the market and take on more medical costs. And then we specify lots of ways you can raise revenue progressively. Got to have to ask more from those at the very top because they have seen just the lion's share of economic growth over the past three decades. And also do things like tax what we call economic bads, so including, you know, a carbon tax to cut down on greenhouse gas emissions, also taxing financial speculation to raise money, raise revenue progressively, but also, you know, tamp down on some of the abuses in the financial sector that were so damaging and helped contribute to this crisis. And so that's sort of the broad outlines of our plan.
I'm interested in the taxation on some of the goods and services that you had said have some significant social costs. You mentioned financial speculation. Talk a little bit about your plan around that.
So basically, it's a variant. It's, you know, not, we didn't invent this. It's been around for a while. Some very smart people talking about it for decades. The idea that a very small tax on the order of 0.25% should be imposed, kind of like an excise tax or a sales tax on all financial transactions. And the idea is that those financial transactions where people actually want to buy a stock or a bond and hold it for a long time, it's actually something that they want to be invested in. It's something that they're going to park some retirement savings in and let accumulate over time. That tax is going to be utterly trivial. It's going to be swamped by lots of other things. I mean, just as an example, just the simple sort of transaction costs of trading, which you have to pay in terms of fees and services, those have actually come down more in the past 10 or 15 years than this tax would impose. So basically, we're going to put transactions cost, including the tax, back to what they were, say, in the late 1990s. And nobody really thought the late 1990s was some terrible time for financial transactions, and they were really, really expensive. On the other hand, those kind of financial speculations that are just rapid turnover, day after day, flash trading, basically that zero-sum game of being the first one to buy and sell a particular thing, the tax is actually going to be relatively significant. And so the hope is two things. One, it's a way to raise revenue that's progressive. The incidence of the tax is going to fall essentially on wealth. And we all know wealth is not very equitably distributed in the country. And then two, almost by definition, the financial transactions that are going to be crowded out by the imposition of this tax are going to be very low value ones. You know, if it's not worth an extra 0.25% to make a financial transaction, it's really hard to make the case that that transaction was really vital and needed and had a lot of economic value.
Josh, what has the response been overall to the plan so far?
Good question. I would say, sadly, I mean, not much. I mean, a couple things. One, I think there's just so much flurry and attention and obsessing over sort of the fiscal cliff and even more narrowly on what is going to happen to the high income Bush tax cuts at the end of the year. And in our plan, we definitely allow those to go away, to fade out as scheduled. But I think that the debate has been so telescoped only about that. And this plan is bigger. It's ambitious. It's not going to be legislated in the next couple of months. And so people are not very interested in things that are not going to be legislated in the next couple of months. To the degree that people have wrestled with it much at all, I think that the criticism is that it relies too much on progressive revenue increases to close longer run budget deficits. To us, that is just acknowledging the sort of crucial economic reality and context that income inequality has grown just to a staggering degree over the past three decades. I mean, just one example of it, between 1979 and 2007, sort of the last year before the Great Recession, the richest 1% of households claimed more of total economic growth over that period than the entire bottom 90% of households. So the idea that when we're talking about closing budget deficits going forward, that we should not be talking about, and over the same time period, tax rates on that top 1% have fallen a lot. That seems crazy to me. So to the degree that there's criticism, it's the idea that we rely too much on progressive revenue sources. That to me is just us recognizing actual economic facts about what has happened in the U.S. economy in recent decades.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Josh Bivens, the Research and Policy Director for the Economic Policy Institute. Josh, you mentioned at the top of the interview that you had two proposals, one which was basically a blue sky plan, which we have been talking about here so far, but also another one just to get us through the end of the year. And I've seen in the last couple of days some reports about a possibility of a plan to get us to hold us over so that more could be negotiated down the road. Tell me about EPI's plan to get us through the end of the year.
So that one is really focused on the problem of what people are calling, and it's a terrible metaphor, but what people are calling the fiscal cliff. And the problem of the fiscal cliff is sort of counterintuitive to how people tend to think about budget deficits. The problem is that deficits are going to fall too quickly in the next year, and that increase in taxes and the decline in spending that's going to lead to those lower deficits is going to suck too much spending power out of the economy and slow the economy down if we don't do something about it. It's not going to happen on January 2nd if no deal is done, but over the next, you know, first couple months of 2013, if nothing is done, if those taxes go up, and crucially, if those spending cuts actually kick in, then you really will see a drag on economic growth. And so to us, we should really do something to address that fiscal contraction. And so we basically say, let the high-income Bush tax cuts expire, that they will provide trivial drag on growth. I mean, these are tax cuts that are not thrown back into the economy because they're directed at very rich people who don't spend a lot of each extra dollar you give them. So those can absolutely go away and do minimal damage to economic growth. Then we take the 10-year cost savings by letting those tax cuts go away, and we devote half of it to more economic support in the next couple of years. And so to give the economy an actual boost when it needs it, instead of allowing kind of fiscal policy to be a drag, we would continue the emergency and even expand the emergency unemployment benefits that have been in place. We still have very high unemployment. People are relying on those benefits, and they provide support to the economy. We would fund some infrastructure projects with that money. Again, we've got huge public investment needs in this country, and it would put people back to work really quickly. And then it's to replace the expiring payroll tax cut. The payroll tax is going to go up 2% for every worker January 1st if we don't do something about it. We actually do a more targeted tax credit that's going to aim at sort of low and moderate income workers in a little more focused way than the payroll tax cut. And so it's not as ambitious as we need to get us back to full employment, but it does more than just keep fiscal policy from being a drag in the next year. It actually provides some support while letting the high income Bush tax cuts, which we think are just wasteful and unfair, allowing those to finally go away.
Josh, in terms of cutting spending, talk to me about the dangers of cutting back on public services.
Yeah, so there's too much attention being paid to the high-income Bush tax cuts. You know, if you look at the economic impact of allowing those to go away, utterly trivial. The economic impact of allowing the scheduled spending cuts in place to go away is literally, you know, almost a million jobs. And so cutting back on public services, you know, there's two problems. One, people don't get the services, and there's never been a time where the services were so needed as, you know, when we're still in this very slumped economy. And then just as a simple kind of hydraulic macroeconomic fact, withdrawing that spending power from the economy when it's still weak will absolutely drag on growth and cost us hundreds of thousands of jobs. So it's would be a much more important and severe drag on growth in the coming year than the high-income Bush tax cuts, which, you know, suck up all the room in the debate.
Josh, as we close out here, ultimately, do you think that a deal will get done before the cliff comes? And also, what will that look like if so?
I'm very agnostic. I would not be shocked if we reach January 1st with no deal. I think the administration, and I think there are I support them in this, but my sense is that they're going to be very firm that the tax cuts for incomes over $250,000 should be allowed to phase out as currently scheduled. I think they're going to be very firm on that. I think the Republicans in Congress are going to be very firm that no deal can happen if they are allowed to phase out, and I don't know how those two things get reconciled. So I think there's a real chance we enter January 1st with no deal. After that, I think prospects are a little better for doing something because now all those tax cuts are gone. And the question then becomes one of all those taxes, you know, they're going to go up because the tax cuts will fade away. And then I think that sort of improves the bargaining position of the administration. But it's very hazy to me. I don't have very good predictions on how it all plays out.
Josh Bivens, the research and policy director for the Economic Policy Institute. Josh, appreciate your time today. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to our guest this week, AFGE Public Policy Director Jackie Simon, Common Cause President and CEO and former Congressman Bob Edgar, and Economic Policy Institute Research and Policy Director Josh Bivens. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you by the American Federation of Government Employees.